Welcome to the Americas Uncovered podcast, where we explore important current political issues and historical trends in the Americas with some of the authors and specialists who understand them best. This is a podcast for Alborada, an independent voice on Latin American politics, media, and culture based in the UK. I'm Peter Watt, and I teach and research Latin American studies at the University of Sheffield, also in the UK. You can follow Alborada on Facebook and Twitter. And if you like this podcast, please subscribe wherever you're watching or listening. Alborada relies on audience funding to continue producing content, so please also consider making a one-off or monthly donation by clicking the support button at alborada.net. This is episode 2, and my guest is Aviva Chomsky, Professor of Latin American Studies at Salem State University in Massachusetts. Professor Chomsky is author of several books, including Is Science Enough? 40 Critical Questions About Climate Justice, Central America's Forgotten History, They Take Our Jobs and 20 Other Myths About Immigration, and A History of the Cuban Revolution. Today, we discuss Professor Chomsky's recent book, Central America's Forgotten History, Revolution, Violence, and the Roots of Migration. While much of the history of the region has indeed been victim to pervasive and systematic organized forgetting, this book seeks to rescue Central America's past from oblivion by providing a necessary antidote to elite-serving narratives which uphold a radically unequal and unfair status quo rooted in centuries of aggressive resource extraction at the service of Spanish colonialism, US imperialism and multinational capital, institutionalized racism, and state-backed terror and violence against the citizenry. Today, we'll talk about what Chomsky means by the privilege of being able to forget, and why we should do everything we can to resist the inclination to ignore history's most important lessons. Welcome to the Americas Uncovered podcast, Avi Chomsky.
Thank you.
Thanks for joining us today. And I just want to say how much I got out of reading your book, Central America's Forgotten History. It's a topic I've looked at a lot and taught a lot about in the past. Nevertheless, your book was very illuminating in uncovering a lot more detail some of the history that I've already read and I've been interested in. I was interested in the title of the book, the idea of forgotten history, and I wonder if maybe you could just start by briefly talking about that notion of forgetting, because presumably not everyone has forgotten, but some people have or never even knew. So what is it in a nutshell really that's been forgotten, and why do you think that is?
So I started thinking about the book because of one particular type of forgetting, which is that I came of age politically, I would say, during the 1970s and 1980s, and Central America was so high on all of our radar, you know, during the Nicaraguan Revolution and the Reagan era and the Iran-Contra affair and the Salvadoran Revolution and the liberated territories in El Salvador and solidarity movements and refugees. And I was in Berkeley, so it was just very, very present. And I started teaching in 1990. And my very first year, I designed a course on Central American history. And I've continued to teach that course since 1990 and noticed two things. One, all those events of the 1980s, as I experienced them, are never taught. So my students who are so much younger, you know, who they were born after 1990, they didn't live through that. They have no way of even being exposed to it. And that's true of my white US American students, but it's also true of my Central American immigrant students who were born after the wars. And many of them know that things happened in their countries and that their parents came to the United States for a reason, but their parents don't want to talk to them about it. And they don't know either. So what felt to me like such formative events seem to have just been erased. And then starting in the, you know, in around 2012, 2014, all of a sudden Central American migrants are in the news. And it's all we hear about is caravans and unaccompanied minors and Central American migrants, Northern Triangle, all this talk about Central American migrants with absolutely no connection to Central America's history. Like, this just kind of came out of nowhere. And, you know, this is a problem with the way news coverage and popular culture tends to erase history in lots of different ways. And, you know, we're just sort of assume that, oh, there are rich countries and there are poor countries, and that's just kind of normal, that's just kind of natural, without thinking, no, actually there are historical reasons that made some countries rich and other countries poor. But it seemed particularly acute in the case of Central America and Central American migrants. And then the other thing that I started noticing in teaching my class is that back in the 1980s and 1990s, there were lots of popularly accessible books written about what's going on in Central America and why. And synthetic books like Walter Lefebvre's Inevitable Revolutions, Export Agriculture and the Crisis in Central America, like books that helped you put Central America, the Central American processes as a whole. And when I started trying to choose books, there's been a huge upsurge of scholarship on Central America since, say, 2000. But most of it is not the kind of thing you can assign in an undergraduate class. It's very specialized, it's very detailed, and it's written in very academic language. So I've been keeping up with all the research on Central America, but how can I teach it? Because there's nothing to teach with. So... Okay. And, you know, the books I was looking to, but they're so old, they don't incorporate any of this newer stuff. And a lot has happened since 1990 in Central America. And you have to understand that, but in its historical context. So those are some of the ways that that concept of what's missing inspired me to write the book. But once I started writing the book, I started thinking about forgotten histories in even deeper ways, thinking about how we in the United States are taught to understand our own history, and how that's distorted, how Latin Americans are taught to understand their own histories, and that's distorted, and all of the ways that US and Latin American history have been intertwined that have not really been written into the history, and especially the US and Central America. So the concept of forgetting actually grew and built as I was working on the book.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I can't remember, I think it might be in chapter one where you talk about this notion of the privilege of forgetting, as you call it, and that actually to be able to forget is something of a privilege, and the being able not to know or choosing not to know comes from a position of privilege. And I thought that was a really good way of thinking about that like I said at the beginning, you know, some people don't have the choice of forgetting, and that it seems to me that what has happened is there's a kind of organized, perhaps, or loosely organized and systemic method of obscuring a certain kind of history that doesn't come to the fore at all. You know, when you were talking about Central American migrants and the discourse from 2012 onwards, you know, I've been thinking a lot recently about how the discourse that you have in the United States in relation to Central American and Mexican migrants is very, very similar to what we have in Europe in relation to migrants crossing the border between Morocco and Melilla and Ceuta, for example, into the EU territory. I mean, there was basically a massacre in June at the Melilla Morocco border, people trying to enter the EU, people from sub-Saharan Africa, people from the Middle East. 77 people are still missing, and 23 people were killed by the Moroccan and Spanish security services. That wasn't in the news. And again, you find the same in relation to Calais, people trying to cross from Calais into the UK or into Bulgaria. to get into EU territory. And it's just all of those stories are part of this organized forgetting, I think. And in the book, go ahead.
Part of that forgetting on the part of the privileged, and I would say the colonizers, today's privileged are yesterday's colonizers and the beneficiaries of the legacies of colonialism, because colonialism is not just something that happened in the past. It's something that continues to evolve and happen in new ways. Now we're in the 21st century or perhaps neoliberal era of colonialism. It's not that, colonizers pull out, countries become independent, and then it's as if the past never happened. The past so deeply continues to shape the present. But, the privilege of the colonizers is to naturalize the global economic order. You know, Central America is poor. Africa is poor. The United States is rich. Europe is rich. We don't want to look at that man behind the curtain. That's like a U.S. Joke from The Wizard of Oz.
Yeah. It's a joke over here as well.
Okay. We don't want to ask too many questions about how this came to be and how the contemporary institutional global order perpetuates these global inequalities. We just want to naturalize them. And that, I think, is a big part of forgetting, not just of the colonial past, but of the way the colonial past, the colonial model is reproduced in the neoliberal era through warfare and interventions, through trade agreements, through international financial institutions, through debt, through structural adjustment. Like, all of these are the neoliberal form of colonialism. But instead, we just think of them as kind of normal things that happen, and we don't want to ask questions about where did they come from and how do they work and how do they create and reproduce global economic inequality.
Yeah, one of the things that you talk about in the book is, in a lot of ways, the popular representations of the civil wars in the 1980s, for example, in Hollywood and as you say, in the scholarship, tend to be quite dated, and they focus on the 1980s as if it's this period in Central America which stands on its own. But one of the points you make later on is to show that actually, in some cases, the violence and the dispossession in Central America is often as bad or even worse than it was during the 1980s. And Honduras is one example that you talk about. Guatemala is another one. Not only has there been a climate of impunity where a lot of the perpetrators went to live in Rhode Island or LA or Florida, in the case of Guatemala, but that the processes really haven't changed that much. And if you think about, levels of homicide or forced disappearances throughout Central America and indeed in Mexico, it's almost like those horrible statistics compare perhaps with what was happening in the 1980s.
Yes, in both Guatemala and El Salvador, we see deaths, violent death, at rates that compared to the war years.
I mean, one of the other aspects about that you talk about a little bit is, I mean, even though there has been this impunity, the kind of rescuing of history from oblivion and the challenge to elite discourse and elite narratives, both in the United States and in Central America, the groundwork for that has been done by a civil society activist organizations, most of them clearly in Central America, some of them also in the United States, solidarity groups in the United States, or groups of immigrants themselves in the United States. And that seems to be the most important job of activists, really, is to create an alternative narrative which more closely aligns with their experience.
You know, I think in a way, you know, one of the arguments that I came to in the book was that I don't think I had fully comprehended before writing the book, was the extent to which the crushing of the revolutionary projects of the 1980s paved the way for the era of neoliberalism and for the neoliberal reforms. And not just reforms at the governmental level, but the, I would say, the neoliberal order, which everything that you're describing is part of the neoliberal order, including the very high levels of violence, which in some ways are a result of the economic model and in some ways are a necessary component of the economic model. That in, for example, violence to dispossess people of their lands that are desired by multinationals for their economic development projects, for their you know, extractive projects, for their tourism projects, for their dams, for their maquiladoras. So it's the model is really based on dispossession. The crushing of the revolutionary movements was in so many ways a decisive factor in enabling this neoliberal era to take root in Central America. And for the solidarity movements, you know, of course, many of the solidarity movements, especially like among Central Americans involved in the solidarity movements in the United States, they were very clued into all of the things that were going on within the revolutionary movements. And it was quite complex, as I talk about in the book. But from the perspective of the US solidarity movement, I think the understanding, and for Central Americans in Central America, the hope that they could actually take their future into their own hands and construct a different kind of society, a different kind of economy. And that was really inspiring to people in the United States too, to have a revolutionary vision that actually seemed possible. And incredibly inspiring that it was some of the most exploited and dispossessed and apparently powerless people on the planet who were actually bringing this about in the here and now. And I think part of the success of the end of the Cold War was of US hegemony at the end of the Cold War was in what Margaret Thatcher called TINA, there is no alternative. The Cold War ends with the triumph of capitalism, and that's all there is. And I feel like, you know, she was talking about the fall of the socialist bloc, but the crushing of the revolutions in Central America, I think, was much more immediate to many people in the United States. And so, you know, what is the project right now? What is the vision? Where do people see hope for constructing a different kind of society and a different kind of world? I think that the crushing of Central America's revolutions was also really influential in the fragmentation of the left in the United States. Like, where can we look for, how can we even articulate the world that we want?
Yeah, and the crushing of those movements, you know, in a lot of ways, I wonder if it was, you know, a continuation of the project that happened in Chile and elsewhere in Brazil. You know, that notion of that Naomi Klein talks about in the shock doctrine, that they, you shock the society and then you can kind of pass any kind of legislation that you like, and very unpopular legislation, anti-union legislation, anti-worker legislation. And in a way, that's probably what happens in Central America too. And I always, you know, whenever I teach this stuff, I always kind of make this joke that, you know, the discourse at the time was that Nicaragua was a threat to the national security of the United States, or that in 53 and 54, Arbenz was, this little country in Central America of a few million impoverished peasants. And you're telling me they're going to overthrow the most organized and most well-funded military power in human history. I mean, it's a joke, but it worked, and it's, you know, it still works. You know, it works in the case of Iraq, it's worked, you know, Libya, you name it. So one of the things I think about that is that, you know, that it was in a way to show up Central America as an example to everyone else and discourage, I suppose, anyone else from getting big ideas about taking things into their own hands. And secondly, to crush any kind of national or international liberation movements and to prevent people, you know, in the heart of the empire from getting any big ideas themselves, right?
And, you know, if you look at how U.S. policymakers talk about the Cuban Revolution, the Chilean, you know, I think we can call it a revolution by, you know, coming through by democratic means rather than by through armed struggle. But, you know, it was a revolutionary moment in Chile in terms of the government's commitment and people's belief that they could really fundamentally and thoroughly reconstruct their society. The Nicaraguan Revolution, there's a real consistency in U.S. reaction and you know, Guatemala also, that if we let this happen here, mm-hmm. people in, you know, I'm focusing on Latin America, but we could, you know, I'm sure if we were to do research on other parts of the world, we'd find something similar. If we let this happen here, other Latin American countries are going to want to do the same thing because it's working so well. We have to make sure it fails. Mm-hmm. That is basically exactly the same thing they said after the Cuban Revolution. We have to make sure this fails. We will do anything to make sure it fails. Exactly what they said after the election of Allende and exactly what they said after the triumph of the Sandinista Revolution. We cannot let this succeed because if it does, other Latin Americans are going to want to do the same thing. And that is going to ruin our economic control of Latin America.
Yeah, there's an interesting quote from Julian Assange that I was thinking about a few days ago, where he said something to the effect of, if wars can be started by lies, they can be stopped by the truth. And, you know, it seems to me that what I was alluding to a few minutes ago, this notion that, you know, the United States is somehow threatened by the small country of Nicaragua in 79, is so preposterous. Is it, do you kind of see your own role as a teacher and an author as kind of trying to undo a lot of those lies and to rescue the truth from, you know, this dominant discourse?
Yes, absolutely. I mean, first of all, I want to recover for students the belief, and not just unrealistic belief, but the actual capacity for people, even the poorest and most marginalized and dispossessed people, to create something different.
Yeah.
So to resurrect that alternative that Margaret Thatcher was trying to erase. It's not just a dream, it actually was happening. It was happening on the ground. So that's one piece. And the other, another piece is to try to open their minds to a more critical view of US policy by asking, okay, what was the United States really trying to do and why? And this is based a lot on their own internal documents. And, you know, it's not just critics of the United States who say, oh, yeah, the United States is doing this. It's what they themselves say that they're doing when they're not being listened to. So that kind of forgotten piece also. And the other thing is that I think that what I've been talking about is, you know, the impact of neoliberalism in Central America, that also is really forgotten and really erased. You know, the dominant narrative has the idea that, oh, the United States is trying to help. You know, sometimes it makes mistakes, but they're really trying to help. And they have all these great economic development projects to help people in Central America. And, You know, we see this being constantly reinforced in the public statements by our politicians that, you know, yeah, we're going to put more money into building this and then everybody is going to be happy. So to try to look underneath, to encourage people to look underneath some of that rhetoric and say, well, what really is the impact of these so-called economic projects that the United States is trying to promote? What is the impact of foreign investment? And, you know, that's kind of a question that inspired me from when I first started working on my dissertation on the United Fruit Company. You know, what really is on the ground the impact of U.S. investment in Latin America?
I mean, I think one of the things your book does is you really get at how, you know, how difficult the kind of politics and alternative forms of social and political organization that were taking place in the 70s and 80s in Central America, what the challenges were and have been since, you know, and which you know, in some cases triggered, ferocious attacks on the part of the state, funded a lot of the time or most of the time by the United States. In the case of Guatemala, you know, I watched that trilogy of films by Pamela Yates.
When the Mountains Tremble.
Yeah, and you know the last film, I think, is it called 500 Años, 500 Years or something. What really comes across in that is not only the struggles that people were going through and risking their lives and risking all kinds of horrible violence, but then since then trying to hold the perpetrators and war criminals accountable. You know, those fights have been led mostly, in the case of Guatemala, by indigenous people and indigenous women, you know, at great risk, and there's no easy answers. And in a way, you know, that comes across in the film, but it also, you know, it shows the process of how difficult that is, but also how amazing and incredible it is that these people managed to get not just one, but two former presidents put on trial. So in the case of Rios Montt, who was convicted, I think, of the crime of genocide and his role.
But never served any time for it.
But, you know, symbolically, and the fact that there was even a judgment in the first place was incredible. When you compare it to, like, Spain, for example, where, you know, that in the case of Guatemala, that's been, you know, a few decades. But in Spain, there's been a much longer process, and there's not really been a really serious historical reckoning.
I understand in Spain, there's also a lot of resistance to pursuing that kind of process. I mean, they're great at pursuing processes against Chilean war criminals and Guatemalan and Salvadoran war criminals who kill Spanish citizens, but it's been a really thorny political issue in Spain, and a lot of people would rather forget. Like Spain today is very different.
I mean, there are mass graves all over the country, and the resistance to having them investigated is still massive, and the political will is not really there on the part of the Spanish establishment, because it's the same families and people who've been in power since the 30s and before. I thought that came across in the book as well, which I thought was really important. And you know, it gives us, in a way, it gives us some tools to start to grasp some of those challenges that people have faced in reconstructing historical memory. So we've talked somewhat about your Central America book, and I would encourage everyone to read it, published by Beacon Press, I believe. I use a couple of your other books in teaching, your book on the Cuban Revolution and your book on 20 myths about immigration, They Take Our Jobs, I think it's called. So yeah, thank you for your input on that. And I really like what you've done, because it brings together a wealth and wide range of material and presents it in a way that I think is very accessible to people like myself and other people who maybe aren't so familiar with the recent history of Latin America. I'd be interested to know what you're working on now.
Good question. So I've been involved in a multifaceted research project that focuses on Northern Colombia for many years now, and I've published some pieces of that. I did a book called Linked Labor Histories, New England, Colombia, and the Making of a Global Working Class back in 2008, that it looked at a whole bunch of different, like, on the ground things. I mean, a couple of things drew me to Colombia. One was when I was teaching my Central America class, I mentioned how, you know, Central America was in the 1980s the biggest recipient of US military aid. It was the place that sent the most people to the US Army School of the Americas, and just, you know, talking about all these different links. And then I just kind of casually, offhandedly said, it was also the place with the greatest human rights violations and massacres and assassinations of social leaders and religious figures were happening. And then I just kind of casually said, and today that's Colombia that is receiving the most military aid and sending the most people to the School of the Americas, and where the greatest human rights violations and assassinations and massacres are happening. And I kind of heard myself say it and thought, ooh, I need to start paying attention to Colombia. And at around the same time, I discovered that our local coal-fired power plant, which I can see from my kitchen window, was importing coal from Colombia. Mm-hmm. And as I was just like pondering those two things way in the back of my mind, I was contacted by an organization on the West Coast that said, we're bringing two indigenous leaders who have been displaced by a coal mine in Colombia that supplies the coal to Salem. We're bringing them to testify at the Exxon shareholders meeting in Dallas. And would you like to bring them to Salem to talk about it? And I said, sure. And that was my initial involvement in this coal mining region. But so looking at, the issue of extractivism has become a huge issue in Latin America in the 21st century. Extraction of natural resources, and both under left-wing and under right-wing governments, the extraction of national resources either only for the benefit of elites or for funding social redistribution, but also a key focus of indigenous and peasant and popular resistance, and also, of course, a key issue in questions of economic models and economic development, but also in terms of climate, as the climate emergency has become more and more visible to everybody in the past several decades, and more controversial in lots of different ways. So in Linked Labor Histories, I talked, among other things, about this coal connection and the invisibility, once again, of, you know, here we have electricity, but we don't really know where it comes from or what impact it's having on people elsewhere, but how intimately intertwined our lives actually are and our privileges actually are with displacement, violence, exploitation that's going on in the third world. So I've been involved in solidarity with indigenous and Afro-descended people being displaced by the mine for years, who are involved in local struggles, mostly to get compensation and recognition of their rights from the mine itself, and also from the Colombian government, and also from the United States, which is the ultimate beneficiary of all of this. Even though the mine is no longer owned by Exxon, a US corporation, it's now owned by Glencore, a Swiss corporation, multinational. But I started looking more deeply into the history of the region and how You know, it's really been sort of a frontier or a zone of refuge where autonomous, indigenous, and Afro-descended peoples have developed their own forms of governance and economic models over the past 500 years. So that's been really interesting. And connecting to the rise of global indigenous movements and what global indigeneity means. And I'm still, like, and also issues of labor and like radical unions and third world unions and how they identify, you know, how unions in the United States have come to identify with the Democratic Party and the US foreign policy in general, although with a lot of dissent, and I look at that too, but how at least some Latin American unions, like the union in this particular coal mine, identify with kind of resource nationalism, like this coal is ours, and so it's an anti-imperialist relationship to extractivism and natural resources, and also identifying with the indigenous resistance to the mine. So that's what my current project, and just thinking about like fossil capitalism and the role of fossil fuels in industry and capitalism. And, you know, on the way I kind of paused to write the Central America book, but it's actually related to a lot of different similar issues. And I also paused to write this book, which I just happen to have here because I'm giving a talk on it this afternoon, Is Science Enough? 40 Critical Questions About Climate Justice. So thinking a lot about colonialism and climate justice. So I'm not exactly sure what form this, exactly what this new book is going to look like, but I'm working on it.
I mean, I suppose the thing that came across in the Central America book was, because you start with talking about the Spanish colonial period and not only the kind of class hierarchies between the Ladinos and the indigenous peoples, but the how the economy was set up to be an export economy of extraction. And that if there's one thing that is a continuity in the last 500 years, it's that it's the extraction of resources at the expense of the people living there and of the natural environment. So I thought that was a really a good way to kind of think about things that perhaps may seem unconnected to many of us who aren't too familiar with that history, and how actually the past is also the present, because as you said earlier, I think, you know, the colonization didn't stop in the 1820s. It, you know, it's continued ever since, and it's, you know, maybe got a different form. So I think your book does a great job of helping us kind of comprehend that and come to terms with that. So I just want to say thank you, Avi, for joining us today. And thank you for listening and watching wherever you're listening. Don't forget to subscribe to Alberada, wherever you're on, whatever platform you're listening or watching. So thank you very much.